your birthday, and over on the corner of the room somewhere on a little table might be a package, and it's wrapped up with a pretty bow on top, and you realize that that's for somebody special, and then you realize, oh, I'm the one that's about to have a birthday. Or maybe during the end of the year holiday season, there'll be a lot of different presents that'll be brought in, and people try to see how creative they can be in wrapping things. And sometimes people can take a pencil that they're giving somebody else, wrap that up in such a way that nobody would even begin to guess that all they're getting is a pencil. They've got it in some large package or some such concealment that nobody would ever be able to guess. That's always been an enjoyment in our family, is to be able to try to guess what somebody has gotten just by looking, of course, at the package. But you know, those gifts that we get are not the only packages that come along. Companies that process foods, companies that process household items, even a shop tool, they have learned that if you package it correctly, and if you make it look as if it is something someone wants to buy, they will purchase it sometimes based on what it appears to be, just sitting on a shelf or hanging in a display somewhere in a store. Experiments have shown over and over again, conclusively, that an item of inferior quality will sell for more money only because it's packaged nicer. Only because it looks more exquisite, although it may not really and truly be. If you package in a bright and an appealing manner, then that'll sell more quickly than a quality product that's been poorly preserved. The devil is not unintelligent, folks, and we're going to talk just very briefly tonight about four different attractive religious packages. And each of the things I'm going to talk about this evening really need to be fully developed, but I'm going to introduce the idea behind each of these things briefly tonight by just describing four things that the devil is very, very effective at passing off as something you want or something you feel you need or something that would be very, very good, when in reality it has no substance to it whatsoever. The devil can make anything suitable to people. He can put things in a style that just cries out, buy me, buy me. I can meet your need. I can give you what you're looking for. And he can give instructions that are so simple that you can make this a part of your life without any serious interruption at all to your job advancement, without any interruption to your family, without any interruption to your recreational activity or anything else that you consider to be important. The devil never wants to package things to look as if you take this on, you've got a whopper of a responsibility now that you're going to have to do something with. He makes it look attractive, and he makes it look simple and very easy and something that you don't have to really do too much in order to utilize. Well, let me just get right into it and tell you that quite often pretty packaging religiously conceals error. And I think you'll see in just a moment what I mean by that. That quite often an idea will come along that has to be sold to people so that they will accept it and believe it and put it into practice. And sometimes the way in which it is packaged, the way in which it is presented, is going to make the difference in whether or not it is accepted. However, that pretty packaging, if you get into it, you find out, well, this is error. This is not according to the truth. This is not according to God's pattern. It looks so great on the outside. It looks so inviting. It looked like something I wanted to open up, but once I've gotten into the package, I see that there's a trouble here. There's a problem with this particular item. I want to begin by mentioning Calvinism to you. That's a very, very attractive package which allows people who buy it to believe that they have no responsibility spiritually whatsoever. Now, you're saying to me, no responsibility spiritually? I mean, these are religious people. Why would they want no responsibility spiritually? Well, when you buy this package, when you purchase this deal, you get rid of responsibility, because at the root of Calvinism, it says that all of us were born to be in whatever state we are, religiously. And in fact, there's not any way you could change your status with God if you wanted to change your status with God. You're either born to be saved or you're born to be lost. And there really is not any way of making any adjustment to that, because all of this was predetermined and preordained, foreordained, predestined by God. That's Calvinistic predestination. There is a Bible doctrine of predestination, but it's not the Calvinistic variety at all. If you were elected to salvation, you can't be lost. That's the once saved, always saved idea. And if you were not elected to salvation, there's no way you could be saved, no matter how much you might do, no matter how much you might beseech God and beg Him to save you and to cleanse you from your sin. You're just going to be lost. Well, a lot of people have bought into this. By the way, Calvinism is only about 500 years old. It came about with John Calvin promoting these ideas, and then it took on his name to represent that philosophy or that approach. And you know, once Calvinism caught on, it caught on because it has absolutely changed the Protestant religious landscape for five centuries. And most people that are caught up in Calvinism don't even know what Calvinism is, but they believe it. They believe its tenets. They promote its ideas. And I'm persuaded that people have held on to it because it removes personal responsibility from their decision about whether they will do this or whether they will do that spiritually. The only problem we have with this is the Bible, because the Bible has a plain brown wrapper. Plain brown wrappers don't get much attention, do they? You want somebody to be attracted to a package, you wrap it up nicely and you put a pretty bow on it and you put attractive paper with it. And here is the Bible in its plain brown wrapper, and it says, "For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Every one of us will give account of himself unto God." Romans chapter 14, verses 10 through 12. The Bible teaches free moral agency. And no matter how you wrap it up, that spells human accountability. Every human being, whether he wants to believe it or not, is accountable to God. And he's going to answer to God for what he did with the gospel message and whether or not he responded affirmatively or negatively. Every man, every woman is responsible for their actions. You see what a pretty package this is? If I didn't have to worry about anything but just say, well, it's all been predetermined and there's not anything I can do but just go along for the ride and let God take care of the rest. That's a pretty package that a lot of people have opened. Here's a second one. You've heard of Calvinism. Bet you haven't used this word all week long. Ecumenism is what that word is. Let me see if I can describe to you what ecumenism is on a practical level. If you were to go down here to Jones Road, just travel the length of Cypress North Houston Road from Jones all the way down to Telge, unless I have miscalculated, and I very well could have, there are five different church buildings, maybe six, from Jones Road all the way down to Telge. Six different church buildings, different varieties of churches, all have signs out on their lawn, sort of like ours. And most people have bought into the idea that as long as somebody goes to church somewhere, that's all that matters. And it does not make any difference what sort of church. It doesn't make any difference what they call themselves. It doesn't make any difference what they teach. It doesn't make any difference what their practices may be as a church. If they claim to love God and if they say they believe that Jesus is His Son, then they're okay. And if somebody should leave us and wander off into this congregation just down the road here on the right, or to that one over on the left, or back up the way here to a couple of ones that are on the right as you go past Huffmeister, then we should not really be concerned, because after all, they're still Christians. And there are people who have the idea that there are Christians in all the denominations. And anybody who would dare question whether or not a person is a Christian and at the same time caught up in some denominational church, well, you're just unloving. Because you know those sincere people would not be where they are unless they were sincere about what they do. That is not the question, by the way. I have no doubt that those churches are filled with people who truly believe what they're doing is right. But you know, if you want a product that requires your total participation, this kind of product is available, because if you want a religion where little will be asked of you, all you have to do is shop around from church to church to find that, and you will find a church somewhere that claims to be in fellowship with everybody who claims to be a Christian. Everybody who wears that name, they claim is their brother. They claim is their sister. All ecumenists have agreed that if you don't condemn my religion, I won't condemn your religion. And that's the way they operate. Now, you can understand that's a pretty package, right? I mean, if that were just true, how wonderful it would be. If you go to an ice cream shop, good place to go on a day like today, and you walk in and there are 16 or maybe 32 different varieties of ice cream behind the counter, and you get to go up and down putting your nose against the glass if you're a child. You'll get by with it then. And you're looking at all of these different flavors, and they ask you, would you like to sample one? And you get a little sample here and a little sample there, and then finally you choose one of those. Nobody is going to fuss at you about that. Nobody is going to say you did anything wrong about that. They're going to say, well, you just went to the ice cream shop and there are all these different ice creams that are in there. And it's not wrong to choose any one of those ice creams that you like. And that's true. But the problem is, a lot of people who are ecumenists believe that's the way it is about religion. That it doesn't make any difference what one believes as long as they are sincere in what they believe. Most people don't like hypocrisy, and so they would tell you, don't be hypocritical. Don't be a member of this church if you don't really accept its beliefs. If you don't follow its tenets, then you find one that you do. But such fancy wrapping does not make a biblical product. Again, the Bible is a little different. Quite a bit different than what that particular idea espouses. Ecumenism is merely a cleverly presented package in which there is really no substance whatsoever. Now, I imagine that there are people in this building tonight who like cotton candy. I am not one of them. If I'm going to eat candy, I want something that's real. I don't want air. And I don't eat a lot of candy. You might not recognize that by looking at me, but I don't eat a lot of candy. And candy that's been spun the way cotton candy is spun is enjoyable, I suppose, out there at the fair or wherever it was that this thing was invented for people to begin using it. I'll tell you, one of the reasons that I really hate cotton candy is that I always was introduced to that at a county fair, and you're walking around and all these bugs and everything else are flying into your cotton candy. And so you end up getting a little protein with your sweets. And I just didn't like that feature. But I didn't like the fact that once I got it in my mouth, it just vanished. It was just gone. There was really nothing to it. That's what ecumenism is, folks. It's people who want church for the sake of saying they're going to church, but they don't care what the flavor is. They don't care what's being offered. They don't care what's being taught. God's Word teaches Christians that they ought to come to agreement, but they cannot come to agreement by compromising truth. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10 has Paul telling the Corinthians that those divisions that they were experiencing there that they should not have experienced them, except that they should held on to the truth, held on to what the Scriptures would teach them. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1, he tells us that here we have one Lord and one faith and one baptism and one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. The world will give you 32 varieties. God has one. One. And by comparison, it's pretty vanilla. Right? Compared to what you might be able to do at a church service, if you could even find one on a Sunday night. What we're doing here tonight is pretty plain, Jane. There's not anything about this that you could say you could sell to somebody on the basis of its attractiveness in that way. Third thing, how about situation ethics? This package allows a man to be religious and immoral at the same time. A lot of people want to be religious, but they don't want to be moral. Well, you can be an immoral religious person if you will just accept this package of situation ethics. What a deal this really is for a guy who is looking for this kind of group. The label advertises a product that states that if a thing is done with what it loosely calls love, then it cannot be sinful. Now listen to that again. Situation ethics at its base says that if you're doing what you do out of love for someone else, then there's nothing wrong that you could do doing it from love, because their definition of love is skewed too, right? They don't understand what real love actually involves. Sin, situation ethics says, is only in the mind. And so you just have to change the way you think. Just change the way you feel about something. Just change how it appeals to you or doesn't appeal to you. The morality of a thing is determined by the situation you're in rather than by an objective standard. Now, the Bible would tell us that there are some things that are always wrong. And the Bible would tell us that there are some things that are always right. But the situation ethicist says that some things that might be wrong for some people at certain times are not necessarily wrong for all people at other times. In other words, it just depends on the situation. Is lying wrong? Well, depends on what you mean to do when you tell a lie. Is stealing wrong? Well, it depends on why you felt you needed to take something from somebody else. And then they'll try to make a determination as to whether or not what you did was right or whether it was wrong. You could be involved in homosexuality. You could be involved in adultery if it's by consent and if the two people are not trying to hurt one another or coerce one another into behaving the way they are. If it's consenting, then it's okay. If it's not consenting, if somebody in that relationship doesn't want that, but they're being forced into it, well, that would be wrong. You see? Situation ethics is the idea that you can do whatever the situation will allow and still be a faithful Christian at the same time. But the Bible doesn't allow it. In Romans chapter 6, and in verses 1 and 2, as the apostle here writes about sin, he says, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin so that grace may increase? May it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live in sin? It is never right to do wrong." Somebody told me that when I was just a teenager. And that is something we need to keep in mind. It is never right to do wrong. It is never wrong to do right. But you'll find yourself in a lot of trouble when you start mixing those things up and trying to redefine what is right and try to redefine what is wrong, dependent on the circumstance that you're in. You cannot be a servant of Christ and do evil at the same time. Apparently, the people to whom Paul was writing the book of Romans, chapter 3 and verse 8, he said, we are slanderously reported, and some people have claimed that we have said, let us do evil that good may come. Paul says, we've never said any such thing as let us do evil that good may come. There are some people that might take that viewpoint, that there is some good that could come out of some evil that somebody perpetrates, or vice versa. And that's situational. That's not at all what the scriptures teach us. No matter how you dress it up, situation ethics is a cop-out. It's a way to excuse sin by blaming the passion of the moment. And if only the passion of the moment had been different, I would have done differently. But because it was what it was at that time, then it was okay and everything was all right. Again, far more could be said about this than I'm saying tonight. Finally, let me suggest this. Institutionalism. This is a package that promises a man that he can do his work by proxy. Now, let me just explain briefly what I mean. I'm sure there are probably some here who aren't quite aware of what that term institutionalism means. Among churches of Christ, what it usually has reference to is the church supporting from its treasury human institutions to do the church's work of evangelism or edification or benevolence. And we have rightly opposed institutional approaches to the doing of the church's work. But I will tell you that most people who have embraced the notion of just being a fundraising group, the church, to send money to human institutions that will be charged with doing evangelistic work or doing benevolent work or doing the edification of the saints, most people that have bought into that buy into it, because what's the easiest thing you can do whenever you're needing to get a certain job done? Writing a check's the easiest thing you can do, right? Now, that's not belittling the fact that it takes some work to get money into an account you can write a check on, yes. But I'm just saying that most people have bought into the institutional concept, because this means that as long as the work of preaching and teaching and benevolence is being done and I didn't have to do it, then that's okay. There's an institution over here that's going to take care of all of that for us. The church ends up becoming nothing more than a fundraising organization serving mainly to satisfy the gargantuan appetites of the human institutions that are constantly calling upon the church for its support. It happens with colleges, where people think that because they teach the Bible in those colleges, or because they were formed or started by somebody who was a member of the church or some members of the church somewhere, that they have a right to come to churches and say, send us money so we can educate your children and raise up your future preachers and raise up your future elders and your future preachers' wives and elders' wives and deacons' wives and deacons and teachers and Christian businessmen and Christian businesswomen. And all sorts of approaches are made by colleges sometimes to get into the budgets of churches. Same thing has happened in terms of benevolence. Somebody decides they want to build a hospital, or they want to build a nursing home, or they want to build an old folks home, and they're going to use that facility to take care of older people or sick people or infirm people. And so they say, well, this is benevolent work. It's doing good for people. So they come to the churches and they say, if you would just support us, we could get this work done. We can't get it done on our own, but if you would just support us, we can build an orphanage, or we can build a widow's home, or we can build a hospital, or we can dig water wells in Africa, or wherever it is that these kinds of things are being done by these various institutions. And people buy into that, because once they've written that check, whoo, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Somebody out there somewhere is taking care of that, and all we had to do is contribute a little bit of money to that. Well, a lot more needs to be said about institutionalism. But the Bible doesn't offer such a fancy arrangement. The Bible does not present the church with the need to be out here doing anything worldwide except it's best to preach the gospel. That's what it's calling upon us to do. And whenever we get involved in all of these other sorts of things which the church has not been given responsibility to do, you find out that there's a reason why. The Lord never said anything about this being a part of a church's work. It's because it's not the church's work. It's just as simple as that. If it is the church's work, then we would have been thoroughly furnished to every good work, as 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16 points out. In fact, what I would suggest to you also is that every time the Lord's pattern for doing evangelistic work or doing benevolent work or doing the work of edification, every time the Lord's pattern is bypassed and some men come up with some other means or organization or institution which is going to actually do that work in the church's stead, it's never as effective, it's never as pervasive, it's never as good as when a local church does what it can do within the confines of its own abilities. There simply is no passage for appending human institutions to the local church to do the work that God gave the church to do. But whenever you challenge someone about why are you doing this, they will say something like this: well, just look at all the good that's being done. And that's attractive, isn't it? Nobody wants to do bad. We all want to do good. And sometimes we will justify anything that comes along if we can extract from it some bit of good that somebody happens to be done as a result of that particular work that's going on. The God of heaven who established the church has given us directive about what its work should be and how that work should be done. And it's not going to be as glorified and not as impressive as what some of the schemes of men have come up with to promote these sorts of things. But it is effective, and it will honor God, and it will accomplish what God intended for it to accomplish. And there won't be any group of men anywhere who'll be able to sit back and say, look at all the work we've done. Look at all the help we've been. And for all these years, we've trained your kids. For all these years, we've helped the needy. For all these years, we've sent preachers into places far and wide. So give us money, give us money, give us money. And that's all the world those organizations do, is come after money from local churches, because without it, they couldn't do what they do. The church has needs. And the church is responsible for collecting a contribution on the first day of the week to meet the needs that a church is rightfully charged with meeting. And whenever we do what we can do to the extent of our ability in doing benevolent work to the saints, and whenever we do what we can do to edify one another, and we plan several things throughout the year, including what's happening right now with a worship assembly and a teaching opportunity and a time, that a place where we can be together, and then the preachers that we support worldwide, different places, and have done for many, many years. That's the Lord's plan. We don't get credit for that. We're not looking for credit for that. We don't want our names in some brotherhood newspaper about what a great church Cyfair is, because look at all the money that they've contributed to this human project or that human project or another human project. And yet that's what goes on all the time in the realm of institutionalism. Pretty package. It's just not God's package. No matter how pretty the package, if God didn't approve of it, it's just glitter. That's all it is. It's just something that looks great, but really does not glorify God. Well, I'm done. You want me to add to this list short sermons? Pretty packages. People like short sermons. But they might not have very much to them. And this one didn't have a lot to it, I'll have to assure you of that. But what I am hoping is that maybe in the future we can talk about some of these things in more detail and flesh these things out so that they can be thoroughly understood. Just be aware that everything that glitters is not gold. We understand that in the physical world. We need to understand it in the spiritual world as well. If you're here tonight, I have nothing to offer you except the invitation of Jesus Christ, who said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. That's all I'm offering you. That's all I'm authorized to offer you. And for those that are looking for the Lord, that's all they need. There's nothing else required but repentance and baptism for the remission of sins. If as a child of God tonight, there are things about your life and things in your circumstances that you need faithful brothers and sisters to pray with you about, this would be an opportunity too for you to come if you need to and ask for the prayers of brethren or to repent of some public infraction against God's will. We'd be glad to help you to do whatever needs to be done to make your life right with the Lord. Let us know how we can help as we stand now and as we sing.